For the week of May 27th, 2018, this is Showbiz Sandbox episode 411, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz. I'm awake, you're awake, I'm not tired, you're not tired. It's going to be a wham-bang episode.
I don't know what you're referring to.
Well, because last week you were traveling.
Exhausted.
The week before, I was up at 7 in the morning. I was exhausted. We've been at 6s and 7s for weeks now, but now we're right back where we started.
Yes, and indeed, I actually thought of you over the weekend as I was watching the, well, it's a play with music, not a musical, but it's a new premiere, actually, of David Henry Hwang's Soft Power at the Amundsen Theater here in Los Angeles.
Oh, isn't, and that's, of course, of interest to us at Showbiz Sandbox beyond the fact that, you know, we like theater, but it's about China and its growing importance in the world.
Yes. And, you know, it was okay. It started off great. You know, all of David Henry Hwang's, you know, the stuff, the play that he was writing there about China's growing influence. And it was actually set in Hollywood and Hollywood trying to make, you know, Hollywood content in China. And it was meta because one of the main characters is David Henry Hwang, the playwright who's writing the movie for the Chinese company. And then the music starts and Hillary Clinton is a character. And it's like,
she's got a lovely singing voice.
You know, it was one of those things where it was like going so well. And by the intermission, I was like, so you're still working on it, right? Because it's better than most of the stuff I see theatrically, but it needs some work, right? And I don't know whether it's headed to Broadway or not. A lot of the stuff from the Music Center does ultimately make it to Broadway.
Right. He hasn't been on Broadway a ton over the years. But yeah, Chinglish went to Broadway and obviously M. Butterfly was just revived. But I'm looking forward to checking that out when it gets here. I'm sure it will come to New York. I had a good weekend. I saw a couple movies. The best one was Summer 1993, a Spanish film. That's the directorial debut of Carla Simón. So a female director. That's nice to see. She co-wrote and directed it. It's autobiographical. A lovely little film. Very observant with a little girl as the lead, a six-year-old, and an even smaller child. Is her little sister of sorts, and it's sad, it's quiet, and they get really good performances out of those kids, kind of like The Florida Project, which it's not like at all tonally, but it's a film where 80% of it at least is just little children, and it's quite good. I think it debuted at Berlin last year.
So very much like the Lebanese film in Cannes this year that I thought had a very good shot at the Palme d'Or and, of course, won some prizes, Capernaum, which is, you know, effectively a child lead.
Mm-hmm. So we had a good weekend. Disney did not, and we'll talk about that this week. But what else will we talk about on Showbiz Sandbox?
Well, this week on Showbiz Sandbox, we're headed to a short time ago in a galaxy not so far away where a studio blows up its IP with one direct hit, or should we say flop. Actually, we'll get to the box office and Han Solo's lack thereof, but we'll also talk about the new head of China's Film Bureau. Does that mean the Middle Kingdom and Hollywood can strike a trade deal? Meanwhile, Comcast is going head-to-head with Disney for the Fox properties. In music news, Sony bought another big chunk of publishing company EMI, YouTube vanquished a competitor, and Korea conquers the U.S. album charts for the very first time.
BTS! Sorry, well, keep going.
Okay, during Book Filter, we make our least surprising pick yet for a movie project. In sexual misconduct news, oh my God, sexual misconduct news, Harvey Weinstein is arrested and charged with rape, as definitive a fall from grace as Hollywood has seen in a long time, if not ever. Plus, Morgan Freeman is the latest celebrity to be called to task for his behavior on the job, while Jason Bateman apologized for downplaying the abusive behavior of Jeffrey Tambor on the Arrested Development set. On Inside Baseball, we'll take a look at one of the jobs on a film or TV set that isn't unionized, the essential but underpaid job of production coordinator. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover the week's top entertainment headlines. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right, and we're looking at box office around the world. We have a link to ComScore in our show notes. We also pull information from Box Office Profit, Box Office Mojo, Variety, Hollywood Reporter, The New York Times, The LA Times, you, our listeners. And we've got movies from all over the world. About 20 are on this week's chart. You needed to gross $600,000 to make it to the bottom of ComScore's list. You needed to gross, that's where Super Troopers 2 is located. You needed to gross over $4 million to make the top 10. That's where Gabriel Union's film Breaking In is located. And you had to gross a solid, big, but people are upset amount of $150 million worldwide to be at number one. And that's where Solo, A Star Wars Story, is on its opening weekend in most countries around the world, except Japan. It grossed $148 million, just about $100 million over our four-day weekend here in North America. It's Memorial Day. $65 million international. It's a disaster.
Yeah, you know, I had a whole bunch of jokes lined up about how, Han Solo, the film couldn't do the box office run in less than 12 parsecs or all the Millennium Falcon jokes you could possibly muster up. But the reality is, Michael, I don't know if you recall when we first mentioned Solo. Okay, this was long before it found its directors or its star. But when we first mentioned Disney was going to do a prequel in which there would be a young Han Solo, we asked ourselves, does anybody want this movie? Does anybody want to see this movie?
I do not recall saying that. No, because this is the easiest one to do. This is the one with Han Solo. This is the one where he's young, he's sexy, he's a rapscallion, he's a smuggler. It's the easiest slam dunk of all the Star Wars properties. Once you get beyond a new trilogy, still dealing with Luke and Leia and Darth and all that, this is the easy one. Obi-Wan, Boba Fett, which people has about 2 minutes of screen time, doing stuff spun off with characters you've never heard of before, Darth Maul or whatever. Han Solo is the one that should be the best. That should be the one that people were dying to see more than any other character. It seems like the best one. You can't have a Chewbacca Solo movie. You can't do an R2 movie all on his own. But Han Solo, young, sexy Han Solo, that to me, maybe I'm contradicting myself from ages ago, but that to me should have been the easiest win.
Well, if we had a huge staff, right? Or if we had, if I had unending time, I would go back through all of our episodes where we mentioned Solo, whether it's, when they were having production troubles with the directors, or whether they were having, trouble with finding somebody for the cast. We always seem to be talking about it negatively. And I guess I look at a film like this and I look at the Marvel properties, and I'm not the only one to be doing that this week. And Disney expected this film to open between $130 and $145 million domestically. It will open.
That's the most recent estimate from like 5 days out. Right. I'm sure they had higher hopes, but yeah, it did poorly. It did very poorly.
Right. And I guess it's been compared to, and I would agree with this, that if you're creating a universe, a cinematic universe, as they say.
I'm rolling my eyes.
Right. And by the way, I'm right behind you in rolling my eyes. Although if you read the New Yorker this past week, there was a very good article that reviews a number of books that talk about current day Hollywood, from talent agencies on to Ben Fritz's book about, reviewing all the Sony emails from the Sony hack. Intellectual property is what rules these days. And if you look
at intellectual property has always ruled. There were King Kong sequels. There were Mummy sequels. There were Dracula sequels. Hollywood has always spun off movies from other movies.
Right. But I guess
intellectual property is not a new idea. They've made 1,000 Robin Hood movies. This is not a new thing. This is not a brand new idea.
Not by any stretch. I guess in decades past, you'd have exactly what you just said, Michael, all of the IP, right? But then you'd also have, Casablanca or other stuff that's
a different issue.
Really, really good.
Whether Hollywood should be making different types of movies, that's right. A different issue. That's a different issue about why this movie didn't do great. The nice thing about this movie is everybody wins.
Well, let me just finish the thought here, which is, and this will, square the circle or circle the square. I can't remember the phrase. But what I was going to say is that it's been compared to Ant-Man, okay, as a spinoff of the Marvel Universe.
That's a terrible comparison. Well, Ant-Man was not in any of the other movies, whereas Solo is an iconic character from the original franchise. So that's a dreadful comparison.
Think they're calling it, box office-wise. I think that's the only comparison.
Ant-Man was a big hit. Ant-Man did great.
But did it open? What did it open to? Did it open to $100 million?
Was a biggest success. Ant-Man did tremendously well. It was one of the best solo films in Marvel history for a first movie for a new Marvel character. It did better than the Hulk. It did better than Thor. It did better than Captain America. Ant-Man was a terrific success.
What about Deadpool?
Ant-Man was a big success. Ant-Man was not a flop. That's just a fact. Ant-Man did great. Whoever, if somebody's suggesting that Ant-Man was a flop, just like Star Wars, Han Solo.
No. By no stretch. By the way, Solo will do just well. So, you know, everybody just calm down for a second. The opening weekend for Ant-Man was $57 million at a time when basically every Marvel film, the Avengers and X-Men, etc., were all making over $100 million for their openings. And I guess that's what they're trying to compare it to, is not every film in a quote-unquote cinematic universe is going to open to, you know, $1 trillion. Basically, that's the comparison that's being made.
That's, again, a very bad comparison, because this is Han Solo, one of the most famous characters of all, and an ideal one to stand alone. Whereas Ant-Man is a minor character with a quirky, offbeat sense of humor that's way far afield of what they were doing in Marvel. It was a real roll of the dice, and it paid off. It grossed more than Thor's first movie. It grossed more than Captain America, the first Avengers. It grossed more than, the Incredible Hulk. Only Iron Man did better, and not by much. Ant-Man grossed $520 million in North America. Iron Man grossed $585 million in North America. That was more, but, you know, that Guardians of the Galaxy did better. That's got a whole team of people. Doctor Strange did better, building on the success of all the others. But Marvel has had pretty much unmitigated success, except for The Incredible Hulk. Every film has done good to great. Han Solo is a main character, and he has opened poorly. Given the word of mouth and the reviews, unlike Ant-Man, which had great reviews and good word of mouth, I doubt it's going to end up doing that well. It did open about half of the last standalone Star Wars movie, and it is, by some measures, the lowest grossing opening weekend since the original Star Wars films back in the 70s and early 80s. Because when you actually look at the opening weekend numbers, you know, it's doing very poorly. But again, everybody wins, because Lord and King wanted to make a fun, quirky, strange movie, and they got yanked off the project. And they can say, see, we were trying to make a good film, and Disney panicked, and they just wanted to make product. Ron Howard wins because he can say, see, you know, I tried to be a good soldier and step in and save this disaster, but, you know, what can you do? And by the way, they really filmed most of it, even though I've read today that 85% of the film was reshot after Ron Howard stepped in. Disney wins because they can say, see, we knew we had a problem. We did what we could, but, you know, it's not working out.
Yeah, you know, it's actually, that is a very good, I don't want to say hypothesis or theory, but it's a very good argument that you're making, because I agree with you. And I do think that
Well, what argument did I make? I just said everybody's got a good excuse to give.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I didn't make an argument. I just said everybody can make an excuse about, you know, it's not my fault. They can point the finger at somebody else. My argument is they just didn't make a very good movie. People can say, oh, it's too soon since the last Star Wars movie. Well, guess what? Marvel has three films in the top 15 right now. They have Black Panther, Avengers Infinity War, and Deadpool. Not all made by the same company, but they're all three Marvel movies, all in the top 15 right now. So there's obviously room. But I know we definitely said, why are you opening this movie up in the summer? Why are you opening up 5 months later? Why not wait till Christmas like the other three that you did? And obviously they're going to do that. They're going to wait 18 months until they put out the third film in the latest trilogy. But, you know, they were announcing this weekend, Stephen Daldry is going to direct the Obi-Wan movie. Oh, and we're going to have James Mangold write and direct a Boba Fett movie. You're all waiting for that. Well, they're going to pull back and say, stop talking about, you know, spinning off 17 movies. They're going to catch their breath, wait a little while, and, you know, figure out what they did wrong, which was they just didn't make a very good movie.
You know, when it comes to the Boba Fett movie, I just can't wait for all to see all of the amazing facial expressions that Boba Fett is known for.
Well, you know, there's huge fans. There are tons of characters. There are tons of books. There are tons of comic books and novels. And there's a lot of stuff in the Star Wars universe. I once thought, you know, Marvel is drawing on 60 years and 50 years of all this rich characters and storylines and stuff. And they've got all these different characters. Star Wars is just three movies. And they're trying to, well, actually, Star Wars is a really big universe as well. There's a lot of books and stuff and storylines that they could draw upon. And they've made good TV shows. They made a good standalone movie, Rogue One, which people sort of liked. It did well commercially. Their first two movies made a ton of money. You know, they're going to be okay. They're going to keep making lots of more movies. But, you know, Marvel rolls the dice. They give directors their lead. They make quirky, offbeat movies like Doctor Strange and Ant-Man. And for God's sakes, Iron Man itself was an unusual movie. People were said, what the hell is this? We never heard of this guy. So once we get out from under of the Star Wars mythos and they start making offbeat, fun movies that feel fresh and new, they'll be doing better than, you know, going back to the well of a Darth Vader solo movie, an Obi-Wan solo movie, right, where we feel like we're just retreading the same territory. But now, I don't know why. Did you see the movie? I have no idea why people have turned on this film of all things. None of the four movies are actually good. I don't even know what to call them because there's three trilogies we're dealing with. But Star Wars, The Force Awakens, and Star Wars, The Last Jedi were both not good. Rogue One was okay. I mean, why they suddenly said Han Solo, this is where we draw the line. This is unacceptable. It was a perfectly bland, fine Star Wars movie like all the others, as far as I was concerned.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I've heard some people make arguments for, well, this is baseline, meaning that now that there's not hype about a movie being, you know, the first Star Wars, The Force Awakens being released over 10 years after the prequels, you know, there isn't that anticipated buildup toward it. And then the trail off as, and you've mentioned this, by the way, in past episodes where you said, look, you know, the first one will open huge, the second one will open a little lower, and the third one will, you know, we'll see. But there won't be nearly as much anticipation. And you were right. And certainly for these spinoffs, there really isn't any anticipation. And I've talked to people, and this is anecdotal evidence, but I've talked to people who are casual moviegoers who said, look, I had to go see A Force Awakens and The Last Jedi. I didn't have to go see Rogue One, and I don't want to see Solo. And yet, I would say it's a perfectly adequate film that if you liked Rogue One, you'll like Solo. It's not a great movie.
Well, it's not a good movie. It's not by any stretch, but Rogue One, you know, made money. Rogue One was a success.
Yes.
I mean, Rogue One grossed $1 billion.
Yeah.
It grossed $1 billion. The Last Jedi grossed $1.3 billion. This one is going to be lucky to hit $600 million.
Well, and of course, there's a lot of talk about the fact that it only made $65 million overseas and only made $10 million in China. Meanwhile, in China, the How Long Will I Love You, or I think that's the name of the film, it made $24 million over the weekend. Now, you mentioned that there were three Marvel films in the top, what was it, 15 at the box office. What kind of dawned on me was the top three movies at the box office are all Disney films of some sort.
Oh, sure. You mean in North America?
In North America, yes. Because
this year or this weekend?
This weekend, actually. No. Internationally.
Well, no, Deadpool is number two. That's not Disney.
Oh, you're right. Because I keep thinking of it as a Disney film because it's a Marvel character. But you're right. It's from Fox. Soon to be Disney. So that's...
Anyway, Han Solo came out. I thought Alden Ehrenreich was okay. It wasn't a good movie. It should have been a lot better. So what? You know, it's not going to make a lot of money. We'll have to see what kind of legs it has. It's never been popular in China. Meanwhile, Avengers Infinity War is doing tremendously well in China. So, you know, they're both Disney, same company. They seem to be gambling and hitting all their creative stride on the Marvel movies. People are pretty happy with them. Whereas with the Star Wars films, they're not.
Well, can I say then, I think Kathleen Kennedy is in charge of Lucasfilm. I have a feeling that might not last for very long. If that continues.
I don't think they should panic after one movie.
No, not at all. What I was going to point out is I finally got to see Avengers Infinity War. You might recall it was released right around the time I was going to Cannes, and I didn't have a chance to see the media screening or see it once it opened.
That's not a good movie either.
Well, that's another story entirely. But one thing that really surprised me Saturday night, first of all, it was hard to find a screening that wasn't sold out. Okay, and I'm in the suburbs of Los Angeles. I was really surprised. It's 5 weeks out, and people are still going to see this movie. And I thought to myself, well, if everybody's going to see Avengers Infinity War, who the heck is going to see Solo?
Well, it made $16 million this weekend. And I think, as I've noticed in New York, a lot of these newer screens in theaters with the nice big seats, they don't hold a lot of people.
No. In fact, those reclining, you know, where they kind of reseat the auditoriums, you can lose between 30 to 50% of your seats in an auditorium.
Yeah. It doesn't take a lot to fill up. You know, when you're talking about a secondary screen with 50, 60 seats, you know, it doesn't take a lot of people in a big city to fill that up. So you go, oh, look, it's crowded. It's well, there's only like 50 people in the room.
Right. And that's why I was only looking at the theaters that have not receipt yet. Like there's four theaters near me. Only one has receipt and they were all sold out.
Well, I when I saw Summer 1993, it was at Lincoln Center. The three people in front of me all used MoviePass, and they handed out a little coupon asking us to fill out a survey. It said, MoviePass members, you know, fill out a survey, win a small popcorn, or not win, but get a small popcorn. And they basically said, what movie did you see? Have you ever been to our Lincoln Center before? Would you have seen this movie if you didn't have MoviePass? Will you come back again? So, they just want to know, who are you?
Right. And so that's the movie theater doing that.
Yes, that's Lincoln Center's, you know, movie theater doing that. The Eleanor Bunin, which is their commercial-run movie theater. They are like, who are you? Why are you here? I mean, everybody was using MoviePass to see Summer 1993.
Now, let me ask you this. Did you use MoviePass?
Well, of course, yeah.
And would you have seen the movie if you didn't have MoviePass?
Well, I wish I could have explained further to them, because this movie, other friends saw it. I had very good reviews, and they saw it and said it was great. And so I might well have spent the money to see it, but there are certainly other films I've already seen this week that I would not have seen, like The Guardians, another French film, which ended up not being good. It had good reviews, but I don't know if I would have spent another $16 the next day to see The Guardians. I don't know if I would have spent $16 to see Deadpool 2. That's number two around the world. It grossed another $100 million. It's just under $500 million worldwide. It, too, was not good. An exhausting movie, really. It was just, you know, the quips and the stuff. The character has always been tiresome, you know, and he's sort of a guy that would be perfect in short spurts. If he would just pop into an Avengers movie, you might enjoy him for taking the piss out of everything. But on his own, you really get bored with him pretty darn fast. You know, you can only be meta so long in a movie and enjoy it. But that's just me. Number three around the world is Avengers Infinity War. Also, not a good movie. $50 million on the weekend. It's about to hit the $2 billion mark worldwide. I feel bad for Disney. They're like, well, those movies weren't good either. How come ours is the one that's such a turkey?
Well, okay. Yeah. I mean, let's put it this way. Between all the Marvel films and the Star Wars films and the Pixar films, every other studio is avoiding Disney. Avoiding the summer.
That's true. I'm looking forward to The Incredibles Part 2. I don't know why it took them so long to make a sequel to that. That was the one Pixar film I really wanted a sequel to. It seemed the easiest one. I'm hoping after all this time that, you know, they didn't have a good idea. I've got to have a little faith in them. But I'm a little worried because they've made a sequel to everything. The trailer hasn't wowed me yet. But, I mean, I loved The Incredibles. That was my favorite film of that year when it came out. I'm going to buy popcorn for that movie. I'm really hoping that'll be a good one. But at number four around the world is a Chinese romantic drama that some people have loved, How Long Will I Love You? It's playing here in North America. It made $24 million in the weekend. It's at $80 million worldwide.
Now, it made $210,000 here in the United States. Mm-hmm. And what I would say is, I wanted to see this film. I was going to use MoviePass to see this film. It would have been maybe the third time I've used MoviePass since January, so I am their ideal customer. I didn't use it in April. I didn't use it in February, so I am by far their ideal customer. You know, I'll maybe break even using it. Maybe I'll get one or two on them, you know, but I'm not going to milk them, okay? I would have seen this. Why? Because of the reviews. The reviews were fantastic because I had heard about... the reviews I read were fantastic. Okay, mind you, I read two reviews. I heard one that basically said it's a charming, Chinese romantic comedy. And so I would have gone, but it was so far away. It was like 30 miles away. It played at like three movie theaters in, of course, and justifiably Chinese neighborhoods. But if they had opened it in a little closer, if they had opened it a little wider, hey, you got good reviews. You got good press. Why not? Open it a little wider. Get one or two more screens out there.
I only see two reviews. Hollywood Reporter was pretty negative, and Film Journal International is the only other review I see on Rotten Tomatoes. I'm interested in where it was playing. I mean, where it was, where you read a good reviews. I'm always interested in the Chinese films. It's hard to get good coverage. It opened on 23 screens. It's not exactly a small opening. You know, 23 screens for a Chinese romantic drama starring people we've never heard of, you know. It cost $9,000 per screen. Didn't tear up the world.
That's actually not bad.
That's pretty good, but it's not, you know, it's not showing, oh my God, this film was way in too limited release. It should have been in more screens. But, you know. Summer 1993 opened on four screens. That grossed $5,000 per screen. You know, Mary Shelley opened poorly. It did better than, you know, everything except the documentary about a fashion world figure called The Gospel According to Andre. That made $11,000 per screen, if you want to play that game of what movies on what screens are doing well per screen. But I don't know.
You want to talk about a recurring character, by the way? By the way, we have totally butchered box office this weekend. Thank you, Han Solo. But The Gospel According to Andre, this is, you're going to have to forgive me, I forget his last name. And he's got three names, but he's a fashion figure who is an editor at large at Vogue. He was in the September issue. He's been in another movie about the creative director at Vogue. He's kind of a recurring character in documentaries.
Okay. I guess that makes sense.
Okay.
You were trying to what?
Tie it together with Solo. You know, recurring characters. Spin-offs.
Oh, okay. Andre Leon Talley is the man you're talking about. Yes. He's a major figure in the fashion world. Back to the box office. China was at number four. Believer is at number five. This is a South Korean remake of Johnny To's action film Drug War. It grossed $10 million on its opening weekend. The movie your mom saw last weekend, Book Club, had a pretty good hold. That made another $10 million this weekend. It's at $30 million worldwide. They say the budget for this movie was $10 million. Really? I mean, Jane Fonda, Diane Keaton, Candice Bergen, Mary Steenburgen. Does this mean they get a piece of the box up? Would they give them, you know, $500,000 each? I mean, that seems pretty low.
No, but they're not exactly, you know,
tearing it up. They're not male stars of their stature would, you know, not make them, you know. I'm just wondering if this budget is accurate or whether they got a piece of the movie rather than giving them a bigger budget. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to get to $10 million. You got four big names there, you know, who all, you know, should get something. You know, they're not making the movie for free.
No. Now, I just saw where we are in recording. We are 20 minutes in and we're still on box office. So,
Michael, I blame you.
I blame Han Solo, okay? But let me ask you this. If we were to highlight just a couple of the films that we want to highlight, what would you highlight for the rest of this week's box office?
There is absolutely nothing of interest going on. I would say RBG, way down at number 19. This is basically a North American release. It grossed another $1 million this weekend. It's going to hit $6 million by the end of the weekend, by the end of this Memorial Day weekend. It's among the 40 highest grossing documentaries in North American history. It's a film about Ruth Bader Ginsburg, the Supreme Court Justice. It's just doing tremendously well. And let's not forget, you know, 30 years ago, documentaries just really didn't get released in movie theaters very much. The idea that they would get seen in a theater, much less be commercially viable, much less be in the top 10 like RBG is a pretty amazing transformation we can lay at the feet of Michael Moore and a couple other filmmakers, you know, that were tremendously good trailblazers like Errol Morris. And then there was the commercial breakthrough of Michael Moore and Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. And now a lot of documentary films get released in the theater. You talked about The World According to Andre. There's the film about Pope Francis that's in the top 40 right now. I think the fact that documentaries are being seen and people are going to them and in commercial runs is a really exciting transformation that we've seen happen in our lifetime.
You know, I would also credit the cable. You know, it's certainly we're seeing more documentaries, more documentary storytelling. So,
PBS's Frontline for decades has made films happen. Cable channels are getting really good documentary films made, but the idea that they're commercial and they're not just medicine, something that's good for you like vegetables, but something that can be entertaining and provocative and exciting. Film critics and film lovers have known that forever, but the idea that they're really getting released and seen, I think, is really exciting.
Well, maybe that's because it's the only other thing you can see unless you want to see a movie where your main characters wear tights. including the animated ones, as you just pointed out with Incredibles.
Speaking of guys in tights, Ryan Reynolds is making a deal with Netflix. Netflix has signed up Ryan Reynolds and Michael Bay. They're going to make a big fat action film for Netflix. It's about billionaires, I think, who fake their deaths or do something to go underground and then fight crime. So it's as if Elon Musk fights crime in his off hours. I guess that's the idea. Sort of like Iron Man, except that they're real people. And to me, this is another really big deal. They did sign Will Smith and had a big action film from him. Will Smith is still a big star, but it's been a few years since he had a really big, successful box office film, whereas Ryan Reynolds is at the hottest point in his entire career.
Yeah, essentially, Netflix is making more movies than all of the major studios combined. So when you are talent and you are an agent and you're looking to place your talent, you need a buyer. And so essentially, the talent is going to work with the companies that are buying. And Netflix is one of them. Amazon is another. Hulu is another. And when you're all the studios and you're making, you know, your big blockbuster tentpoles and little else, well, you know,
this is a tentpole picture. This is not, again, an art film or a passion project.
No, I understand that. I understand that. But again, they're not making films that don't have, a built-in audience. So this may not have a built-in audience. I would argue in other words, I'm in agreement with you that they should be making films like this theatrically. I don't mean Netflix. I mean the studios and or Netflix, whoever wants to make them and release them theatrically, they should be, because I think, other than Marvel, I think we're all tired of superhero movies. So, hey, why not return to making decent movies no matter where they come from?
Well, I don't think this is an argument for that. This sounds like just another piece of product.
Oh, okay.
Fat franchise movie. This is a big, fat franchise, first of many movies with six billionaires fighting crime. This isn't exactly, you know, some bold, interesting film like The Sisters Brothers. This is product, just like all the others. I thought it was just interesting that Netflix was nabbing an actor at the peak of his commercial fame. That's pretty interesting. If they make a deal with Will Smith or, you know, somebody else who's on the downward slope like Adam Sandler, you know, that's still a good get. That still is interesting. But Ryan Reynolds, he's got the number one movie in the country last week. That's pretty amazing. China has a big new number one as well. They have a new head of their film bureau. Remember, China moved the government agency in charge of films to their propaganda arm, and they have just named the new head of that China Film Bureau. I don't know how to pronounce his name. I forgot to look it up. His last name is Wang Xiaohuo, Xia Ohio.
Yeah.
You know, I really should have looked that up. I don't know how to say
his
name.
I tried to look it up. It's impossible. And I learned from Soft Power over the weekend, no matter what we do, we will always be mispronouncing the name, because there's four tones in Chinese, and apparently the Americans and English speakers can't hear or say any of them.
No, it's true, but it is nice to try.
Right.
And I think it shows you can tell when one has put in the effort, other than when one says, well, I don't know. Yeah, but when you put and pronounce that name, you get nothing on YouTube, which is sometimes where I find them. But more to the point, I don't know anything about Wang. I don't know who he is. I don't know what this means in terms of policy, what we can gather or discern from the fact that he has been named the head of the China Film Bureau. We don't know. I know Hollywood is wondering, hey, now that there's somebody in charge, does this mean we can make a deal and not let it get sucked into the trade battle between the U.S. and China? That's certainly their hope, and perhaps we'll find out in the next few weeks.
Well, it does mean one thing. It means that he's in good standing with the Communist Party, that is for sure.
Well, yeah, of course. You're not going to be in government if you're not in good standing.
I try to always, you know, point out the obvious.
Oh, good, good. Well, you succeeded right there.
Okay.
Can you point out the obvious about Comcast? They're sweetening their bid for the Fox properties that are in play.
Yeah, so they're coming in and they're saying, look, Fox, I know Disney wants to buy you, okay, for $52.4 billion. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to make that very difficult by offering you $62 billion. And now please take that back to your shareholders and to your board and try to figure out a way that you say no to us, because you have a fiduciary responsibility to do best by your shareholders, even if your largest shareholder is the Murdoch family.
Now, excuse my ignorance. This is going to be an all-cash offer that will be bigger than Disney's $52.4 billion stock bid.
Correct.
Does this mean Fox values stock from Disney more than cash from Comcast? Because presumably they could use the cash and buy Disney stock if that's what they really wanted. I mean, they want to sell it. Why the heck would they care who buys it as long as they give them the most money possible?
Well, because they're also looking at, which deal can get done? Okay, is the Disney deal a little bit more, easy to get through antitrust regulations, or is Comcast never going to happen because they already own NBC Universal. They're never going to, the Justice Department is never going to allow this deal. So even though it's $10 billion more, it'll just never happen.
But Disney has the same issues with ABC and their cable holdings. There's no difference there.
Yeah, I think.
And they're not buying the network. They're buying, you know, regional sports networks, the film and TV studio, and some cable channels. So I don't see any difference in that way as far as being approved by the government.
Well, they are all. Well, Disney is not an ISP, okay? They're not a cable provider. So that's, another strike against Comcast. And let's face it, Comcast bought NBC Universal. I think the Justice Department is a little sad that they approved that deal at this point. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think some investors are sad that their company invested in MoviePass, but guess what? There's no news this week. Isn't that amazing?
It is, actually. I did have one question about this Comcast deal.
Uh-huh.
I wonder if it's just Comcast trying to drive up the price on Disney.
No, I can't imagine they're going to make a massively complicated deal like this, go public with it just to like screw around another company. I think they've got better things to do. It's not a deal or a thing you can do casually. You can't say, oh, I'll give you more, you know. So I doubt that. People always wonder about that, but I think this is too complicated a deal in order for that to be a feasible possibility, that they're just playing games. But that's just my opinion. I just think it's too complex for them to be playing games. But clearly, Sony is not playing games when it comes to music publishing.
That moves us on into music, I guess, where we have a lot to cover. We usually don't have a lot of music news, but this week we do.
That's right. The first big story is that Sony has bought another 60% of EMI Music Publishing. They now control 90% of that company. They basically own the whole thing.
So that's actually good for them because, as everybody knows, publishing is where the money's at.
Well, it's one of the places where money's at. It's certainly a gold mine. That's what Michael Jackson learned from Paul McCartney, buy publishing. And that's what Sony has done here. They have doubled their publishing catalog with this one deal. What I was unable to determine is how much of the music publishing world they control, but I know they've added in songs by Queen, Alicia Keys, and Kanye West, among many others. They paid about $2 billion for this chunk of EMI Music Publishing. They already own 30% of the company, but now they own 90% of the company. And we do know that in the music industry world, as compared to other record labels, they control about 32% of that market. So they have about a third of the music industry, and now they have a big, big chunk of music publishing.
So, you said that Paul McCartney told Michael Jackson that publishing is a good place to find money. And I think that was right before Michael Jackson then bought the Beatles catalog.
Whoopsie.
Yeah.
At least he was listening. At least he knows he was paying attention.
Exactly.
But here's my question to you. This is a big play into intellectual property, into the entertainment business. And we've been hearing rumblings that Sony is not happy with the movie studio. They may just want to get out of the business altogether. And here I feel like they're pivoting from saying we are an electronics company back to embracing the fact that there's a lot of money to be made in the entertainment industry. Do you think that's a fair read?
I think that is a fair read. Everybody always wonders, like, seriously, Sony, are you in or are you out? Because you keep saying you're out or you keep hinting that you're out, but then you keep saying you're in because you keep doing these things that say, we're all in. So you keep raising the stakes, and yet sometimes it seems like you're not all that interested. What's going on?
Well, they bought a big chunk of music publishing, which means they're probably happy about a new decision by YouTube.
That's right. I guess YouTube is, they've added a songwriter label and publisher credits to all of their fan-based videos. And the official videos.
Usually the official videos, it would have been included by the record labels. Now they're uploading that information into all the fan-based videos as well. They know if you're using a clip of a song or an entire song, and now they're adding in all that information so that people can just click on a button and say, oh, who wrote this song? Who publishes? Whatever. It's going to make ultimately, it of course promotes the songwriter, which is really important, but ultimately it makes collecting royalties easier. The more information encoded into music videos, the more ways they can find to monetize it and track it and make sure people get their penny's share of profit. But there's another level to this as well. Music Business Worldwide is where I saw this story, and they say by default, YouTube is therefore building something akin to its very own global rights database for music. which may alarm some of the more suspicious elements of territorial PROs around the globe. Ooh. And I assume PRO is a publishing rights organization.
That's right.
So there are companies like ASCAP and BMI all over the globe that try to track this stuff. And this website is suggesting, hey, maybe YouTube sees a good business they could get into.
Yeah, I don't think YouTube is going to get into that business. It's far too complicated. It's far too much work for too little reward. It's not in their wheelhouse at all.
Okay, so it's not an issue.
Yeah, I think that's just a way to, you know, have a blog post or a way to extend a blog post, because I would be really surprised if YouTube did that.
Are you surprised by the fact that Vivo gave up?
I am a little surprised by the fact that Vivo, of course, is the... It was a company that had both mobile apps and videos. It basically, I was surprised it started in the first place. I thought, well, why not just place all your music videos on YouTube?
Well, because the record label said, we don't like the fact that YouTube controls this huge area of business. And so we want our own competitor because we can get a bigger cut of the money if we do it ourselves.
Right. But then they put all of their videos on YouTube. So they basically ceded control to YouTube by saying, well, we want a lot of people to see our music videos because they are advertisements for the albums and for the songs. And so we need as many people to see them. And not a lot of people know who Vivo or what Vivo is. So we will, let's just put our stuff on YouTube. And well, 9 years later, of course, guess what? Nobody goes to Vivo anymore. They all go to YouTube, where they watch Vivo content. So Vivo just said, you know what? Forget it. Just take all the music videos and just give us a cut.
Right. It was just they launched a competitor and then caved right at the start.
Yeah, pretty much.
So that didn't work. But there is some cool news in pop music beyond, you know, business deals and competitors giving up and throwing in the towel. And this is very cool. We talk a lot about the worldwide film industry and the great success that films in India and Korea and China are having in Asia and all over the world. And here in the U.S., Korean boy band BTS has topped the U.S. album chart with their new album, Love Yourself Tear. They are the first Korean act to hit the top 10, and now they're the first Korean act to hit number one. They did it mostly through album sales, not through streaming, which I find interesting. And they're the first primarily foreign language album. There are some English lyrics, but basically it's in Korean. And they've hit number one. It's the first one to do that in 12 years. Il Divo, a classical quartet crossover, did it in 2006.
Okay.
So, you know, it doesn't happen a lot that an album that's not in English hits the charts. Usually if it does, it's some sort of big Spanish pop singer crossover star. Now we've got an album in Korean, basically topping the charts in North America. It's one of those groups where there's like seven boys in it. Each one is prettier than the last. And they're a huge band in Asia. And of course, especially Korea. They put a lot of work into conquering North America, and now it's paid off.
I'm surprised it didn't happen in the 80s with Menudo.
Well, Menudo might have been, but they also recorded in English a fair amount.
Oh, good point.
But Menudo was definitely bigger in Latin, Central, and South America. There wasn't as much crossover. And even if they were selling albums in the U.S., it wasn't reflected as easily on the charts because those charts were based on what record store employees reported. And they were not recognizing that country albums and Menudo and others were selling. They just said, oh, yeah, the new Springsteen's selling a lot. You know, it was self-reporting rather than actual sales. So if Menudo had happened in the era of SoundScan, they might well have been bigger on the album charts in North America.
Good point.
So that's why K-pop gets to be up there. They have replaced Post Malone's Beer Bongs and Bentleys. That had a three-week run at number one. What I find interesting is that it's basically album sales that did it. I would have thought a little boy band like this, it would have been streaming, kids streaming music. And now I'm wondering a question that I don't know the answer to. Maybe you do, or maybe one of our listeners does. Streaming music, do people who stream, I would have assumed that'd be a younger demo. Surely it is, that the people who are more likely to stream would be younger people.
You know, I used to know this, that, you know, certainly you get reports all the time, and it's one of those things that I always read the report and I go, ooh, I'm going to log that away in the back of my mind so that when Michael asks, I'll remember. And guess what? I did log it away in the back of my mind. And guess what? I totally don't remember.
It might be that young people just watch YouTube and other stuff, whereas older people are paying the $10 a month for streaming. I mean, obviously, a lot of young people are streaming. But maybe that tilts slightly older. So, you know, a good question for our listeners. Tell us.
Yeah, you can write to us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can also follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/showbizsandbox. All of that information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com.
So BTS is number one on the album charts. Donald Glover has been number one on the Hot 100. I haven't seen if the new chart has come out yet, but boy, his video, This Is America, is tearing it up. Don't you wish you were Donald Glover? He's the biggest star in the world right now. His music video has reached like 200 million views. It's been number one on the Hot 100, and he's got Atlanta, an exceptionally well-reviewed TV show. That's the coolest show on TV, probably, and he's the best thing in Han Solo.
Yes, and he can say, he's got an excuse too, you know, he can say, look, I know the movie didn't do that well, but hey, it isn't called Lando, okay, it's called Solo, it's not my movie.
Now that would have, yeah, but everybody liked him best of all, so he's a winner, and if, you know, there's, hey, do a Lando spinoff, you know, no, please don't. One more thing I noticed in music is that Variety posted a review of the new Shawn Mendes album at midnight, Thursday night, Friday morning. Albums are now dropping on Fridays again. They used to drop on Tuesdays for many decades. Now they're dropping on Friday again. And that means they're available for streaming on Friday. And I actually kind of wondered, when that review popped in at 12:04 a.m. or something like that, I thought obviously they were holding on to that review and waiting to release it on Friday. I wondered if the album itself was available. Maybe it wouldn't be available till the morning or the afternoon on Friday. But no, I checked. As soon as it was midnight, that album was available for streaming on Spotify. So now albums are dropping. So if you're a big music fan, you can stay up late Thursday night and start listening to that new album right away.
And please do it while you're going to see the midnight screening of whatever big blockbuster is being released.
When you don't have to wait till midnight, right? Now, on Thursdays, you can go at 5, 6, 7 p.m.
Yes, that is true.
Books, of course, still release on a Tuesday. Most of the time, new books hit the stores on Tuesday. Not that people go to bookstores anymore.
I did go to the bookstore this week, and I actually stood in line. I was at a Barnes & Noble in my neighborhood. There was nobody in line in front of me. It's just that the part-time employee behind the cash register was just busy doing other stuff, not paying attention to whether anybody was in line. And that's because, of course, they fired all of their full-time staff. And, you know, who knows who's behind the register. I finally had to walk up to her and say, are you open? And she went, oh yeah, I guess I am. So somebody's going to bookstores, and it's me.
What were you buying?
A magazine, Monocle magazine.
Well, there you go. Well, this week in Book Filter, there is a book I would recommend that Hollywood option. Somebody probably already has. In fact, I'm kind of wondering now why a short story or book by David Sedaris hasn't already been turned into a film or TV project. Maybe they have been, or maybe people just think David Sedaris is such a distinctive person that the best way to enjoy it is to hear him do it in tour or on audiobook or just to read his book. But his new book, Calypso, is getting probably the best reviews of his career. And it is a darker, more substantial book. It's a lot about his family and his sister who fought addiction and then committed suicide, his relationship with his father, his siblings, his husband. And it's really great. It's really funny, as always. But when you read it all at once, these pieces that you've seen in The New Yorker over the last few years, and you see it together, you can see it's got sort of an arc and a vibe to it. It feels like a collection of pieces that are interlinked, and it really has a cumulative effect that's really quite powerful. You know, he's very funny and scathing, but he's always hardest on himself. You know, he doesn't let himself off the hook. And I think there is the bone of a really interesting movie that could be done here.
Well, okay, in 2013, Kyle Patrick Alvarez turned COG, COG, which is an acronym, into a movie, and that's a David Sedaris. I want to say it's a short essay or short story. They're all self, they're memoirish. So, Sedaris was quoted at Sundance as saying, "It was painful to be reminded of how pretentious and horrible I was," because it's a film about when he was younger. And a story about when he was younger. So it's actually based on an essay from Sedaris' 1997 collection, Naked.
Oh, well, I knew there was a short film, but I didn't know a feature film had been made. But and it stars Jonathan Groff and Dennis O'Hare.
Yes.
So quite a good cast, too, though apparently not a good movie. Yes. Looking at the reviews, it didn't pull it off. So I had looked somewhere and not spotted any David Sedaris credits, but there you go. They've tried before. It's time to try again.
Yes. Now, speaking of again, it is time once again for us to cover sexual misconduct news.
Well, that's a good week. Harvey Weinstein
was arrested. Good week. Good week is when we have none.
When a predator who has raped multiple women and created havoc and despair for decades is brought to justice, it's a good week. Harvey Weinstein was perp walked. No, he wasn't perp walked because he turned himself in. But he was arrested in New York City. He's been charged with rape. He pled not guilty, and he's out on $10 million bail. He had to relinquish his passport. He has to wear an ankle bracelet. He's being monitored, and I think that's good news. And, you know, the stories continue. Morgan Freeman was the latest person to come up with misbehavior on set and with fellow employees. Very unpleasant stuff. Not rape, but sexual harassment, making people feel uncomfortable, touching them, fondling them, making inappropriate comments. He seems dumbfounded and confused. What? I'm not allowed to ogle younger women and touch them and massage them when I want to? No, actually, you're not.
Well, you know, here's a Morgan Freeman story for you. I've interviewed him many times, and I guess maybe the best story I could tell about this particular, I don't want to say incident, but that relates to this these accusations is he's been given two awards at CinemaCon and Show West. They were about 10 years apart. And when he's given an award, he doesn't like to walk up the steps. You know, he was in his, I think, late 60s or 70s the first time, and he's 80 now. The first time was walked out by, you know, they walk the women out with handsome men. They walk the men out with beautiful women. And the first time he's walked out onto the stage, brought to the podium by a beautiful young lady, and he starts off his speech by kind of making a joke like, hey, lucky me, like kind of pointing over at the beautiful lady. Well, 10 years later, he does the same joke. It's, you know, yes, he's kind of complimenting the beautiful young lady, but at the same time, you know, yeah, okay, you're 80 years old and yeah, okay.
Well, when you're in an interview with CNN promoting a movie and a pregnant female reporter is interviewing you about that movie, you're on camera and you look at her pregnant and eye her body and go, gee, I'd like to get up in that.
Well, that's he didn't say that. He did not say that.
He said,
boy, do I wish I was there.
I wish I was there looking at her vagina. Yeah. What do you mean? He wants to be inside her. That's what he told a pregnant journalist. Boy, do I wish I was there. If that's not creepy. And that's to a journalist when he's promoting a movie on camera. Imagine what he's doing in private. Clearly, the guy has no sense of boundaries or what's appropriate. So, you know, he's like, what? I can't be a jerk. I can't ogle women. No, actually you can't. Can't make people feel uncomfortable. Can't give them massages. Can't touch them whenever you want. Can't make, you know, one employee said when he was interviewing her about, working for him, it was on the set of Through the Wormhole. He looked her up and down, eyed her, and then said, how do you feel about sexual harassment? Ha ha ha. You know, massaging women, touching them, making them feel uncomfortable, asking them to turn and twirl around for him so he can look at them and see what they look like. You know, just basically a creepy old man.
Yeah,
you
know? I mean, not in the, like, I'm going to do anything about it kind of way, because...
No, but you're a powerful person. You're the star of the movie. You're setting the tone, and they are feeling like sexual objects. They are for your pleasure to be looked at and ogled and touched whenever he wants. That's not acceptable. Guess what? You shouldn't touch your employees. Do not touch other employees. It's not hard.
did you hear or read his statement over the weekend?
I read both of his statements.
Okay.
He's like, I didn't sexually assault anyone or offer anybody work in exchange for, you know, sex. It's like, no, you didn't, but you still behaved like a jerk and you behaved inappropriately and it's not acceptable.
I wonder what the ramifications will be for someone like Morgan Freeman, who, you know, certainly he was the voice of the Vancouver trains and public transportation, not anymore. He was the voice of Visa, not anymore. You know, I wonder.
People don't want to be associated with a dirty old man, as a guy who's creepy and makes you feel uncomfortable. That's not something that they want their product, linked to. However, I will say one thing. You know, the story broke, And 2 minutes later, there was an email saying SAG-AFTRA is rethinking their Lifetime Achievement Award to Morgan Freeman. You know, relax. Nobody is sitting around thinking, wow, Morgan Freeman is sexually harassing women. I wonder what SAG-AFTRA is going to do about that Lifetime Achievement Award. That's really not anybody's, you know, immediate list to check up on. Just relax and say, you know, we don't know anything about this and we'll wait to let this play out. You know, you don't have to weigh in and tell us, oh, we're going to pull back that award. You know, that's not the most important thing in the world.
I agree.
But Jason Bateman, however, you know, they had an Arrested Development cast interview and they talked about Jeffrey Tambor, of course. And Jessica Walter, virtually in tears, is describing how much he screamed at her on set and said she'd never been treated like that in 40 years of working. And people know actors are mercurial and difficult and tensions sometimes get high. She said, never in my entire career was I ever treated with such disdain. And he's screaming at me. And she is in tears as she describes this. And the other actors try and downplay it. Jason Bateman. And what's his name? Both like, oh, well, you know, people have their process and, you know, it's like later he's like, wow, I really was a dick. I do apologize. And he apologized profusely, whereas David Cross isn't very good at apologizing.
No. Yeah. Well, and, you know, I guess they were faulted with mansplaining Jeffrey Tambor's behavior.
Right. Well, I just say it's a different world. You know, stuff that you know, your instinct is to just sort of make nice because you're giving an interview and to downplay things because you're in public. Well, maybe you shouldn't be doing that anymore. Maybe you should be paying attention to the person who's almost crying next to you while they describe how humiliated and angry they are over what happened to them. But it's a changing world. One thing I would say, you know, what these actors say in interviews matter. Morgan Freeman can't even behave himself during an interview. God knows what that means he's doing on the set. And the way we talk about this is important. When Harvey Weinstein was arrested on Friday, some of the headlines initially said Harvey Weinstein turns himself in as if like he took some proactive positive step. No, no, no. The guy was being arrested. The fact that they let him walk in is not like something that you should sort of imply gives him credit. He didn't turn himself in like, all right, here I am. No, no. The guy was arrested and charged with rape. Similarly, at Cannes, when Asia Argento gave her speech at the closing ceremony, one of the New York Times headlines says, the Me Too fury at Cannes strikes Cannes. I'm like, fury? You know, why are you describing a woman, you know, speaking out and saying I was raped and people who rape should be held accountable as a fury, as if, you know, it's just a vengeful harpy out of control? You know, words matter. And you got to think twice about your headlines and your articles and what you're describing and how you talk about it. I was glad to see people pull back on Harvey Weinstein and say, well, let's not give him credit where credit's not due, as if he did something good by turning himself in. He didn't. He was being arrested and they let him avoid the perp walk.
Actually, they did the perp walk with him from the police station to the car that he had to go to get to the courthouse to be arraigned.
Right. But I mean, saying they didn't.
He was in handcuffs.
Yeah, that's in handcuffs. But like, he turned himself in does not imply anything good on his part.
No,
it sounds like it does. You know, it sounds like, oh, look, he turned himself in, as if he, you know, well, he did the responsible thing. Like, no, no, no. The guy was being arrested. That's all.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah. But I think it's a very big deal. I mean, other studio heads, other powerful people in Hollywood have crashed and burned, of course, in the past. But he's I can't remember any studio chief or somebody of that stature on the executive side. Maybe
Charlie Chaplin or, you know,
Charlie Chaplin never, I mean, he left the country, but not in that sense, but like maybe David Begelman and the scandal of stealing money.
Yeah, maybe. That's a good point. Yeah.
You know, as far as an executive, you know, Charlie Chaplin being a movie star who was just sort of pilloried for his political beliefs.
Yeah, but, you know, I heard you use two words in, you know, recently, and some of our listeners maybe can rewind to hear those two words. And big deal were those two words. Yeah.
I did not notice that.
Yeah, so it's time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story. The name is Bond. James Bond. And Universal has got him. In a heated bidding war, Universal won a piece of the upcoming 007 film dubbed Bond 25. In a complicated deal, MGM is keeping North American distribution and worldwide rights to digital and TV. Universal got international rights as well as worldwide rights to physical home entertainment. I would hate to be the accountant on that film. Big deal or big whoop?
I guess it's a big deal because international is where you want to be when it comes to Bond. That's where most of the money was made on the last three films. $400 million for two of them came internationally, and then $800 million and $680 million for the most recent ones. So that's where the money's at. If you had to choose between domestic and international is certainly what I would want. So Universal won, I guess. And isn't it adorable that they got the rights to Blu-ray and DVD? So cute.
TV's newfound love for live specials continues. NBC has just announced that their next live musical will be, drumroll please, Hair, the hippie-loving rock musical best known for profanity, toying with the American flag, sexual freedom, an anti-war stance, and especially, and this is the big thing, full frontal nudity.
Let the sun shine in. Oh, wow, nudity.
Yeah, bring the whole family. And how will they handle the full frontal nudity? NBC says, they'll figure it out. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal because it's so stupid.
Yeah.
even if you do Hair well, that's not a good live musical to do for TV. It's not a great show. The only recent productions that worked were immersive, which obviously you lose on TV, and it's not family friendly at all. It's not a show you couldn't bring your teenage kid to on Broadway. It's not scandalous. You'd see more shocking things on cable every day. Don't get me wrong, but it's drug use, sex, and nudity. So since you're going to have to downplay or eliminate all of that, what the heck is the point?
The music?
No, because most of the songs suck. You've got Let the Sun Shine In and The Age of Aquarius. Those are the best numbers. It's right at the end of the show. Most of the others aren't that good. They're dragged out skits about, you know, hippiedom and, you know, free love and peace and anti-war. You know, everything about it. Anything that works well is stuff that's going to be in your face. And the stuff that doesn't work well that feels dated is going to be even more dated when it's on TV rather than, you know, with an immersive vibe where hippies are handing out flowers to the audience and you sort of just go with it. So it's just a bad, bad choice.
While Showbiz Sandbox doesn't cover video games all the time, that's more because the industry keeps a lid on its numbers the same way DVD and Blu-ray numbers were kept on the old hush-hush. They made so much money, they didn't like to boast about it. Case in point? Two new video games have set the world on fire with their success. Fortnite and God of War are raking it in. That's why worldwide video game revenue in April hit $9 billion. That's right, $9 billion, which is almost as much as Hollywood grosses in North America in an entire year. Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a very big deal because the reason they made so much money is not because they just dropped and they made their big amount of money on opening weekend sales of video games to people. It's because they've made a big change in how they make money. It's a shift to ongoing revenue streams where they give you video games for free or for a more modest amount rather than the $80, $90 they were charging. But then when you want to expand or add characters or add levels, you pay a little bit of money.
Yeah, it's the freemium model.
Right, it's the freemium model, and it's working like a charm on video games. People are happy to do it. They're you know, when you do the game right, and the new additions are cool, people are happy to keep chipping in a little bit of money here and there and there and there, and it's working great. $9 billion is a lot of money.
Now, I would like to cue the news stories that will inevitably appear, if not this year, next year, or the year after, about people who have spent an entire fortune on whether it's Fortnite or you know, insert name of game.
Dad sells grocery money to keep playing video game.
Exactly. You know, the addiction of how the video games are like built to make you keep plowing money into them. You know, it's I'm sure those stories, if they haven't been written already, certainly will be.
Absolutely.
Now, Netflix may not be king of the hill, but it's sure making it a battle for bragging rights. One day last week, Netflix stock hit a record high that made it valued at more than Disney. It didn't last for more than a few hours, with the Mouse House regaining the lead by the close of the business day, but the fact remains that both companies are valued at more than $150 billion. Disney has a worldwide empire of theme parks, TV channels like ABC and ESPN, a film and TV studio containing Marvel and Star Wars and Pixar, among others, Broadway smashes like The Lion King, toys, games, merchandise, and a library of films, TV shows, and cartoons, the envy of the world. And what does Netflix really have? A library of original and rented content. That's it. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal. Is Netflix overrated? Are they overvalued right now?
I think basically the answer to that is if somebody tried to buy Netflix it would not sell at $150 billion. In other words, it's valued at $150, but I think you could probably buy it for less. But look, it's a big deal in the sense that they're eating everybody's lunch on the production side and on the, you know, they're the biggest buyer out there when it comes to...
But who suffers because they're succeeding? I mean, it's not a zero-sum game. I mean, Disney is not suffering at the box office or in its other properties because Netflix is around. It's a competitor. But, no, you know, but NBC can have a hit show and ABC.
I wouldn't use Disney as the example. I would use Paramount, Fox, maybe Universal.
Aren't they more competing with TV networks than film studios at this point?
And I would also actually, you know, highlight those as well. That's a good point.
Right, but just because, you know, ESPN is a hit doesn't mean, you know, ABC is not. Or just because CM is making money doesn't mean that, you know, Disney Channel isn't. Maybe the other thing is, you know what? If you could just have a library of content and stream it right to people and have them pay you every month, isn't that a hell of a lot easier than setting up all this other rigmarole? Maybe that's just, it's the wave of the future, which is what Disney wants to do with their own streaming service. Are they going to unbundle a ton of value by having a standalone streaming service, just like Netflix is?
I guess we're going to find out, aren't we?
Yeah.
Well, and Netflix is going international. They just signed a deal with Kim Magnussen for some Nordic movies in, Scandinavian languages.
That's right. They're making deals all over the world. They've got most of their growth is happening overseas. Most of their customers are international, not in North America. So they need to make more and more content in the language of the people that are paying them good money. So this is just one more example of that and a good one.
Andy Warhol is, well, he's dead.
And what?
Actually, he's been dead for a while. But now the magazine Interview is joining him, and you may be wondering, like, what the heck? That was Andy Warhol's, he started that magazine. The fashion-friendly form has been around for almost 50 years and finally called it quits thanks to unpaid contributors and allegations of sexual misconduct amidst management. By the way, we don't mean freelancers like Michael wondering where their $300 check has disappeared to.
Hey.
Well, no, by unpaid contributors, we mean people filing lawsuits saying they're owed $60,000 in one case and more than $500,000 in another. Big deal or big whoop.
I can't imagine still writing for somebody who owed me $60,000. That's a lot of unpaid fees. I say good. I'm glad it's dead. I've always hated Interview. Do you know why?
Why?
Do you know why?
They wouldn't
because
hire you.
They had No. Well, they wouldn't because they mostly had celebrities interviewing other celebrities. That was their big innovation that everybody does now. But they would say, let's have, you know, Carrie Fisher interview Tina Fey, right? That would be what they would do, have a celebrity. So that means me, poor schmucky freelance writer who just wants $200, I'm out of work. When they have the celebs do the interviews and give the interviews, there's no need for writers. So I've always despised them because they were just sort of like, they cut out the middleman and I'm the middleman. So, you know, it was a beloved institution. It was innovative. A lot of people copied what they did. They had a great run. You know, can't be that sad about it.
Good morning, America. Or should we say good afternoon, America? For the second time in 6 years, the ABC Morning News franchise is expanding. The Today Show already airs for 4 hours most days of the week, and GMA clearly wants some of that extra income. So they're growing the show, too. But instead of airing it from 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, they're canceling the cooking show, The Chew, and placing a third hour of Good Morning America in the afternoon. They did this in 2012 for a few weeks, but quickly retreated. But now they're going to try it again. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. You know, they've tried it before. They'll try it again. We've been around so long, we remember the last time they did this.
That's right. Yeah.
But the big thing is, you know why they're not expanding to a third hour in the morning? Because of The View. The View is already a monster success. It's fought off competitors. The last 3 years, it's been growing its audience. Last year, it was the only show of its type in the day part to grow its audience. So they're doing great. They're making tons of money, and there's no reason for ABC to mess with success. So unlike NBC, they just said, let's leave things as they are in the morning. Let's try this thing again in the afternoon. I don't know if it'll work because it just feels weird to suddenly pop up in the afternoon, but maybe they'll pull it off.
Now for this next story, let's pretend your home smart speaker responds to the name Alberta rather than the name that will turn it actually turn it on and drive you nuts. So not to mention, by the way, it would record your personal conversations and send them to friends and neighbors, but that's another story entirely. So for this next story, let's just say Alberta is the name we're using. In any case, parents with kids may soon be saying, Alberta, tell us a story. The publishing company Hachette is partnering with Amazon to create an original narrative contest expressly for the Echo device. That's in addition to the narrative content already being created via Amazon's audiobook division. This sounds more like the stuff created for radio shows back in the day, but updated for a smart speaker. Up first, guess what? A choose-your-own-adventure story called Classroom 13 Skill. That doesn't even sound like a title. About a teacher who discovers a lamp that will grant each student in her class exactly one wish. It's our wish you would rate and review this show on iTunes, but until that happens, tell me, Michael, is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, I think it's a big deal because, I mean, home smart speakers are really upending radio. People are creating original content for them. If I could do it, I'd love us to be able to say, you know, Alberta, play Showbiz Sandbox. People can't do that yet, can they?
They actually can. I just have to put our podcast on the right service and they will be able to do that.
Are we able to get on that service?
Yes, I just have to actually have time to do it. So, yes.
Oh, for the love of God, I know your child was just in the hospital. Focus, man. Focus on what matters. Your child is fine. She just had strep throat, we thought maybe, but she didn't. She's just sick. She got the flu, and she's doing better.
Yes.
So, not to play light. But by the way, Alberta, funnily enough, is a great little song by the band Elliot Brood, which I like to pretend I discovered them because I saw them when they weren't signed to any label in Canada. I saw them in Toronto. If you go to Spotify and look up Oh Alberta, it's a catchy little road number, you know, where they throw in different cities. But in this case, they're Canadian cities. So if you love Canada or just want to check out a fun little Americana sort of tune, check out Oh Alberta.
Well, and what I would say is Classroom 13 Skill, the reason the word skill is in that is because all of those little, you know, feats that Alberta does are referred to as skills.
Oh, well, there you go. And, you know, again, it's Alberta. Oh, I see what you mean. Okay. Yeah, and, you know, it's good. It's something different. It's interactive. It's original content. I mean, they are basing it on something else, but they're creating it in a way that it uses the smart speaker in a different, fun way. Doesn't mean it's the wave of the future and there's going to be a billion interactive games, but, you know, creating specific content for it, it's kind of cool and interesting. I'd love to create maybe a podcast and, hey, check out this song, that song, the other song, and play them for you. And every week you can just play my playlist, but with me commenting on them, you know? So it's more like a radio show. Don't know if I can do that yet because I don't have the rights to play songs. So
yeah, you'd have to get clearance, actually. That's a big problem, and All Songs Considered does that kind of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Big labels and big radio companies can get away with that stuff. But I think it's interesting. It just shows how disruptive the smart speakers are and how everybody wants to get in on the game.
Well, that wraps up Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week and moves us along into Inside Baseball. Inside Baseball is where we have some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, this story will only affect you if you are in motion picture or television production, which, by the way, a lot of our listeners are, so that's one of the reasons we're covering this story. Well, now, as casting directors, we've talked about this, Michael, they continue to push for recognition on Broadway. You know, they want to be a part of the union. Variety is now shining a spotlight on one of the remaining jobs on a film or TV set that isn't unionized, the production coordinator.
That's right. It's Variety just basically said, hey, this is interesting. Did you know the production coordinator isn't unionized? And in fact, I spoke to somebody who works in the film and TV biz, and they said, oh, wow, I didn't know that. So it is used to be considered sort of a secretarial role, just sort of a role. And thus, perhaps, I'm not sure about this, but my guess is it might have been staffed more by women and thus underappreciated and underpaid in the past. Well, the job of production coordinator has become more and more complex and important, but it's still not unionized. Its members belong to Local 871, but they're not recognized. And when they tried to push and say, hey, let's have a flat rate, basically the networks and the studios wouldn't play ball, and the number they offered up was so low that the 871's members said, you know what, we're better off not doing it at all right now. So, you know, this union is atypically easy to join. You just have to do like 30 days of work and then pay a small fee. So when you're that easy to join, which is very unusual, you don't have a tight little house, and threatening to strike is not as effective. So it's hard for them to strike the fear of God in studios. But the fact is, these people are maybe making $1,800 a week, working 70 hours a week.
And I can tell you, almost every production coordinator out there will say, who's making $1,800 a week and are they hiring? Because that's a lot.
Yeah, well, it's a significantly lower, even at that level, than best boys and most other positions. It's usually a stepping stone position.
Yeah, you know, I mean, basically, the line goes production assistant, right? So you're like a PA, go get me coffee. And then, you know, eventually you become a production coordinator. And then from there, you can go on to, you know, production supervisor, unit production manager, line producer, producer. And there are different types of productions. There is, you know, commercial production for television advertisements. There's music video production. There's television and film production where you might have different units where, you know, you'll be a production coordinator for a specific unit. But certainly, it was always something that when I was in production, you always strive to then become the next thing. So if you were a PA, you wanted to be a production coordinator. If you were a production coordinator, you wanted to go on and be a production supervisor. But I will say that you were always constantly trying to justify your day rate.
But also, let's be clear, it's become such an important position because it's sort of like the nexus where a lot of things happen. When you have an issue, if you're not quite sure who to reach out to, you reach out to the production coordinator. They arrange travel. They arrange all sorts of things. And a lot of things flow through them. If you do a flow chart of what happens on a film set, who do you turn to when you have a question? Unless you know the person to speak to, you just speak to the production coordinator. So yeah, it can be a stepping stone, but A, that's no excuse for paying people poorly. And B, it's such an important role that now there are people who just do it, just like there are other people who are always gaffers or best boys or, you know, some other roles that need to be done on every project. So what the suggestion is that there needs to be a tiered pay structure for, you know, making acknowledging, you know, what kind of budget are we looking at? Is this an ongoing TV series or a one-time film or a one-time commercial? And then mixing in the experience level that you have. And that's how we can come up with a flat rate based on the type of project and your experience level, what you should get paid. That's what they're hoping to do. Nothing particularly is happening on this level, but Variety just said, hey, look at this. One of the last people not to get unionized. And guess what? They're not making much money.
Yeah. And if not a flat rate, certainly a base rate.
Okay. What's the difference?
Well, a flat rate would mean you have to pay a certain, I guess a base rate and a flat rate are kind of the same thing, but you can always go above a base rate. You can't pay below it. Yeah. In other words, it doesn't necessarily mean you will be paid the flat rate. You could be paid more, whereas a base rate means you can't go below. I may have just described, you know, a difference without a, you know, I can't remember the saying, you know, an explanation without a difference or something like that. Definition without a difference.
Well, that's how you're dying on the vine here, aren't you?
Yeah, pretty much. Speaking of dying, actually, Paul Block died. He is a publicist who I had worked with a number of times, trying to schedule interviews with various big name clients like Sylvester Stallone and Bruce Willis and Tom Cruise. I mean, you name the actor, he's probably represented them at one point.
Yeah, no, I've probably spoken to him myself. He was just a major publicist around for a long, long time. Hollywood Reporter described him as really adept at putting out fires. I think that just happens to be the sort of clients he had at a certain point later in his career. He's like, these people got in trouble, they called Paul Block to help with sort of damage control. But, you know, a big player, always had a different sweater on every day, 78 years old. And that seems young to me. It's not, but in my world, it's just like 78. I'll be furious if I die at 78. But Philip Roth lasted longer. He died at 85. And dear God, the Nobel Prize managed to screw him over one last time. Every year, famously, he would sort of sit around waiting to hear from his publisher to see if he'd won the Nobel Prize. And this year he was stymied because they didn't give out any award at all. Next year they're going to give it out twice, but it can't be him because you have to be a living writer.
Yes, that's right. And although I will say that I just read in the New York Times on Sunday that they might not hand it out in 2019 either.
Oh, I didn't see that. Well, isn't that interesting? But Philip Roth, obviously a titan of American letters, He did some of his best work late in his career, which is a little unusual. Usually people have a peak period, but he really came on fire later in his career with the trilogy in containing American Pastoral, which may be his masterpiece, The Human Stain, and I Married a Communist. But, you know, long before American Pie, there was Philip Roth with Portnoy's Complaint. And in that book, the teenage hero had sex with a baseball mitt and his family's dinner. So take that, you know, Hollywood comedy. Philip Roth was there before you. And one rabbi, I mean, it was very controversial because people said, oh, you're painting Jews in a bad light. You know, you should only put your best face forward. You know, we like black people saying we only want Sidney Poitier. We don't want, you know, Shaft and blaxploitation movies. Philip Roth said, pshaw. But they really had a backlash for a long time. One rabbi said, you know, Portnoy's Complaint did more harm to Jews than the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Oof. And he was serious. Yeah. You know, famous anti-Semitic tract. So, you know, always waiting for the Nobel Prize, often fiddling with his Wikipedia page, taking issues with what he saw as inaccuracies, retiring, you know, saying I'm done, putting a little post-it note on his computer saying the struggle with writing is over.
Yeah.
So an interesting, fascinating career, a lot of really good to great novels, certainly a terrific writer. I've still got a lot more I haven't read by him, but I did read that trilogy, and he's a major talent, and he's gone.
And we're gone for this week, actually. So if you'd like to hear us next week, please subscribe to us on iTunes, the Google Play Store, Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. You can usually find us. And if you can't, please do let us know. You can go to our website, showbizsandbox.com, where you will find ways to contact us. Dirt at showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's D-I-R-T at showbizsandbox.com. You can also call and leave us a voicemail. The number to call is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. You can follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @ShowbizSandbox, or you can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/ShowbizSandbox. Of course, all of that information, as well as links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on their website, who is mgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's BTSForever.com.
.com. Yes. Well, if you can't find any of Michael's coverage of the entertainment industry there, why not head on over to michaelgiltz.com, where all of his work is aggregated. Of course, don't forget to check out bookfilter.com to know what you should be reading. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.
You know, if Star Wars had been a hit, we could have been done with this show half an hour ago.
That is true, because it would have been boring, and all we would have said is another Star Wars movie, another $1 billion. Moving on.